Americans are among the world's leading experts on the topics of weight management, lifestyle medicine, and micronutrient deficiency. Their high success rate working with adults and children to achieve sustainable weight loss and reverse health and disease conditions has made their consultancy really sought after by celebrities, athletes, and top corporate executives around the world. Jason Calton authored a study published in the Journal of the International Society of Sports Nutrition that we mentioned in a recent podcast. That study showed how most diet plans don't provide everything your body needs. Jason and Mira Calton come on Upgraded Self Radio to talk about how micronutrients can improve your health, your longevity, and your performance. Jason, Mira, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right. First question. How did you get interested in micronutrients in the very first place?
Well, it all started because I was diagnosed with advanced osteoporosis at the age of 30. So I basically had to start learning about micronutrients, basically to try to reverse my advanced bone disease. I had the bone density of an 80-year-old woman at the age of 30. And, you know, all they want to do is throw a bunch of medications down my throat and how, you know, set me on my way. I realized by starting to do a lot of this research, and I started figuring that my habits had been really poor and that I wasn't taking in enough of these essential vitamins and minerals. Luckily, I found Jason and we started working on a program together that would be able to reverse my bone density and bring me back to regular health, which I am now. We were able to reverse it in only 2 years. And what we realized is that it had been my own dietary problems as well as lifestyle, poor lifestyle habits that had caused it. And we just really enjoy the research that we did on micronutrients. And so it ended up being the focus of the next 6 years of our lives.
It's amazing how a little bit of enlightened self-interest can make you really face facts versus sort of believing myths, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, if someone had told me that, you know, I was doing things to myself that was going to cause me to be sick, I mean, I thought I was doing everything right. I mean, I was eating low-fat muffins for breakfast that were whole wheat. And then I was having my spinach salads for lunch. And I just kept thinking, you know, I've got it all down. I go and do hip hop class, you know, for hours a day. And I had no idea. But, you know, unless someone put it up to, you know, they put a mirror up to my face and said, you know what, maybe you aren't perfect and maybe you haven't been doing everything right. So, yeah, it was a hard lesson to face, but it was pretty necessary.
It seems like just about everyone listening to the show knows that they aren't doing things perfectly, but they think they're doing it pretty good. Like if we asked everyone, they would say, oh, I'm an 8 or a 9 out of 10. But if you look at their health results, it's pretty obvious that some of them are mistaken, at least in my experience. Do you come across the same kind of psychology when you interact with people?
Yeah. Yes, I do. I think we as a society think that, you know, I think if you were to poll people, you'd find that probably they'd say, I'm doing 80-90% right. You know, maybe I could have a few changes, but you're right. You know, one out of two of us are dying of heart disease and cancer is almost right there. And obesity is on the rise and diabetes is overtaking it. And so you're right. I mean, I don't see how people think that they're doing it 80 to 90% right if we're all, you know, if the average number of medications that most people have in this country is 14 prescriptions a year.
So 90% of us can't be average. I get that. Did you see evidence of this? You were going out on your Calton project, and in fact, you should maybe introduce what you did on your project and what you learned from your travels.
Right. So we went out on this thing called the Calton Project, which was a 6-year, 100 country, 7-continent exploration of for Mira and I to look at how it was that certain people in certain societies and certain regions were healthy. And then how come, you know, so many of the people in the larger cities or in the urban areas aren't? You know, we would think that with our hospitals and with our doctors and with our medical knowledge that we would be in the urban areas and in the large cities the healthiest people. And then those, you know, quote unquote, those poor, helpless, unfortunates out there in the remote areas, you know, well, they are probably suffering from some terrible diseases that we, you know, we don't want to talk about. But it's just the opposite. When we went to these remote areas in Papua New Guinea or in India and China and just all over the world in many different areas and in eating many different diets, we found that the people in the remote areas were the healthiest. they didn't have cancer. They had never even heard of cancer. They certainly didn't have diabetes or heart disease. Obesity was non-existent. Women over the age, you know, after they had children, after a few years, you might see a few who had, you know, a few pounds on them. But I mean, these people are walking around basically buck naked, and they may have a few extra pounds, which is typical for a woman to store a little bit more fat, but they wouldn't even be considered overweight in our country. When we moved to the semi-remote areas where the traders would start to come in and bring in the margarine and the sodas and the chips and all the processed foods, we would then start to see a little bit more obesity and signs of pre-diabetes. But then, of course, by the time we got to the large cities, it was just like it is here in the United States. So our main theory there was that we came to the conclusion is that micronutrient deficiency is really the most widespread and dangerous health condition of the 21st century because it's a silent epidemic. Most of us don't even know that we have it.
That's pretty powerful experience and definitely a major conclusion to come to. Army, I think you had a couple questions you wanted to ask specifically about micronutrient deficiencies.
Absolutely. When you were on your Calton project and you're looking at these people, what are some of the symptoms or diseases that you saw caused by micronutrient deficiencies in these populations? And how did they differ between the different groups?
Well, the individuals who lived in the really remote areas really had absolutely no signs of deficiency because they weren't deficient. They were completely healthy. You'd have 100-year-old workers, like they'd be working in the fields. And they're 100 years old. And when we would work with our translators to talk to them, we'd find out that they're just as healthy today. They're living and they're thriving. They're eating fresh foods. They're doing everything right. And then when, you know, we didn't see very many diseases in those regions, we saw
some albinos in the region. That was about it as far as the deficiency was concerned.
Yeah, only in certain areas of Papua New Guinea did you really start to see some deficiencies. And that, I believe, was you saw a lot of albino children. But that was really the only thing that we saw in the remote areas.
Yeah.
As we moved more into town, of course, you know, we started seeing all of the obesity levels. And, you know, that was something that we really spent a lot of time cautioning the different groups on as we traveled around, trying to tell them about what we were learning and what we were seeing and how they could be preventative for themselves.
Yeah, I think Mira makes a good point, and maybe something that the listeners might think about is that, you know, for years I've been saying that there's different types of people. There's certain people who can eat one thing, and then the person who eats the exact same thing, one person starts to see themselves get overweight, and the other person, you know, can eat those foods, and they don't see any difference. I call some people like that the unlucky people, the regular people, and the skinny fat people. So the regular people, like would be somebody like Mira and I. If we overeat, our bodies are going to gain weight, and they're going to tell us that something's wrong. Whereas I know people, you know, from different cultures and different genetic backgrounds that can eat chocolate cake every day and literally have a six pack of abs. Their bodies never give them that signal of gaining the weight, which, you know, that's why I call them the unfortunate people, because they're the first ones to scratch their head when their doctor says, well, now you have heart disease, or now you're pre-diabetic, because they never saw it coming. So, you know, one of the things I want to caution people is if your body's giving you those signals, take advantage of them, because those signals are direct links to specific micronutrient deficiencies.
That is a perfect segue into my next question. When you're looking at these signals that your body is giving you, it seems like they would manifest themselves in pretty much infinite ways. Are there any diseases that aren't at least partially exacerbated by nutrient deficiencies?
I would say, you know, I love that you asked that question. I was looking at it and you know, my answer to that is no, I don't think there are any. And not only that, not only is the answer that I don't think there's any diseases that aren't at least exacerbated by more micronutrient deficiencies, I don't really think there are any of the lifestyle diseases that aren't caused by micronutrient deficiencies. And that's really the difference, you know, what our research is showing us. And research today in modern medicine, I mean, the headlines across the board have been coming out about vitamin D. But this is just the darling of the day, you know. It's the same thing for all of the micronutrients. Obviously, in the past, vitamin C, you cause scurvy. And you've got, you know, the B vitamins causing all different deficiency diseases in the past. But it doesn't matter. If you're deficient in calcium like Mira was, you're going to get an osteoporosis. But what we don't understand sometimes in our society is we like to think, you know, one micronutrient, one condition. I wish it was that simple, but it's not. Like with Mira, for instance, her bone density issues happened because of a deficiency in calcium, yes, but it was also a deficiency in D and vitamin K and all those accessory micronutrients that play almost like an orchestration in the body to create health.
It's a pretty big statement to say that you think that all of the lifestyle and kind of degenerative diseases are caused by micronutrient deficiencies. I mean, someone who eats all polyunsaturated soybean oil and McDonald's hamburgers, is this a micronutrient deficiency problem or is this a macronutrient deficiency problem?
See, it's a great I love that we're having this conversation because I have been, trying to yell from the tallest mountain for the last 20 years that we've really been looking at I think only half of the equation for the last, 20 years in America. We've been trying to come up with this magic macronutrient ratio, so we've got different camps. We've got the low carb camp that believes absolutely that's the way. You got your low fat camp who can make an argument, that they think is just as good. And then you've got your Mediterranean camp and of course your paleos and of course your vegans and then your vegetarians. And then, it goes on and on. And we're all looking at this, trying to figure out what exact macronutrient diet is going to produce health. What we've kind of all missed, I think, And it's good that we're starting to see it now, is that no matter what dietary profile you're following, if you're paleo or vegan or low carb, it doesn't matter. That one thing we all have in common is that micronutrient deficiency causes disease in any one of those profiles. So, for instance, if you're a paleo and you're deficient in calcium and D and K, you're going to get osteoporosis. If you're a vegan and deficient in calcium, vitamin K and D, you're going to get osteoporosis. You can put any macronutrient philosophy in front of that statement, and if you're deficient in those micronutrients, you're going to get that disease. If the diet was the solution, then you should be able to put another diet in front of there. And if you were deficient in those micronutrients, you wouldn't get the disease. But since you can't, the disease doesn't come from the macronutrient equation. It comes from the micronutrient equation. The way that the macronutrients equation can be beneficial is there are certain dietary profiles that just allow for a wider spectrum of essential micronutrients to be taken in. And so, of course, we believe that the wider the spectrum, then the more likelihood you are to be sufficient in them.
So is this a chicken and egg problem? It seems like on maybe a low toxin diet, you might need fewer micronutrients than on a high toxin diet.
Absolutely, yeah.
When people ask us sometimes, they'll say, what about eating organic vegetables? Is that important? I say, from a micronutrient standpoint, studies go both ways. Some studies show that they are higher in micronutrients and other studies, have been less than, positive on that. I said, but from a toxin standpoint, you're going to take in fewer toxins by choosing things that are organic. So in that respect, it's absolutely better to choose your organic food.
It's kind of funny. I definitely agree with you there. And within the Bulletproof diet, which is some people call it, an upgraded paleo kind of thing, but it's a low toxin, paleo compliant diet. I do talk a lot about, getting the right vitamins from your foods, but I've come across probably 30 or 40 physicians who practice anti-aging over the years, and almost every one of them has said vegans don't heal very well. But when I talk to these vegans, it's not like they're the, I only ate tofu today. Like, these are people sincerely trying to do the best for their health, eating, every color, baskets of every kind of vegetable, et cetera, et cetera. Are they still micronutrient deficient? Like, what's going on there?
Sure. Don't forget, your micronutrients are your vitamins, your minerals, and your essential fats. So, I think, there isn't very many books about being a vegan that doesn't talk about the micronutrients that are just inherently deficient in that style of diet. Obviously, if you don't eat animal source proteins, there are going to be certain, limitations there with the different micronutrients, as well as with the essential fats. I mean, maybe they're taking ALA in with their omega-3, but remember the conversion rate of the ALA to the EPA and then to the DHA. I mean, we're talking about 5 to 10% and 2 to 5% respectively there. So, are they going to get the necessary EPA and DHA they're going to need for their brain or their heart function? Science says no.
Additionally, a lot of them are doing a really poor ratio of the omega-3 to omega-6. So then all of a sudden, yes, that brings in more inflammation. So a lot of the vegetarians, well, they think they're doing fantastic things, and many are, I'm sure. But some people, when they start with all that olive oil and a lot of those nuts, they don't realize that the omega-6s are going up a lot faster than if you just did fish oil.
And another thing with that omega-6 is that, don't forget, omega-6 competes with omega-3 for receptor sites. So yes, when that omega-6 gets up to that 30-to-1 ratio, which a lot of the vegans are because of the fact they're taking in so many of the omega-6, that the ability for the, that a little bit of omega-3 that they are getting in from that ALA source is diminished even greater.
I would say that those are really good observations, and I occasionally come across people in the bulletproof coaching practices where they're vegan and you can go so far, but I sort of feel like without addressing those core things you just talked about there, it gets really tough. So how could someone, vegan or not, though, like, know that they're deficient in a micronutrient? Like, what are the specific signs that our listeners should be sort of asking of their bodies when they're trying to figure out what's happening?
Well, the first thing we would suggest is that we have a quiz online at CaltonNutrition.com where you can go in. It's 50 questions. It's free. And it asks you those lifestyle questions and those nutritional questions that will kind of give you a snapshot of if you have poor habits that might be making you deficient. But, I mean, it's simple things. I mean, are you overweight? Women who are who are vitamin D deficient are on average 16 pounds heavier than women who are sufficient. Do you have a lot of cravings for sugar? You could be magnesium deficient. You have cravings for salt. You could be calcium deficient. Do you not taste things well? You could be zinc deficient. It goes on and on. I mean, high blood pressures, potassium, calcium, and magnesium deficiencies. So it's looking at all those things. So how is your body working? If it's not working to a point that you feel good, then you most likely have a deficiency.
Yeah, I think Mira makes an excellent point. A lot of times people ask us, you know, if I'm taking, I take this multivitamin and I eat right, but I don't feel anything. Well, that's kind of the point. We're not talking about creating micronutrient sufficiency so we can be superhuman. What we're trying to do is create just being human, just being regular. The whole point is to have your body function properly so that you don't have the aches, you don't have the pains, you don't have the brain fogginess, you don't have the taste bud sensitivities, you don't go to the doctor and says, oh, you have high homocysteine levels. Well, guess what? That's vitamin B9, vitamin B6, vitamin B12. We know this. Science knows this. If you're starting to get osteopenia, guess what? It's not, you know, genetic. It's going to be a micronutrient deficiency. Those cravings Mira talked about, you know, science has known for years that cravings come from different micronutrients that are deficient and that our bodies are trying to tell us to eat the food so that we can get these micronutrients. So, you know, I think it's a really good point. And, you know, feeling nothing, feeling great, having no aches and pains, that's your best kind of indication that you're probably not too deficient.
So on the topic there of being superhuman, which is definitely sort of part of the bulletproof idea that says, you know, you really want to be able to do more than you could do before. I would argue that a person in a natural state of health would feel superhuman compared to most people today, but can use micronutrients to go a little beyond average. I mean, I don't want to just be healthy. Like, I want to kick ass. Micronutrients going to help me do that?
That's normal.
Okay. There we go. Resetting normal.
Yeah, we think humans are pretty amazing. You know, we're a pretty amazing species. I think that, you know, what we've been able to accomplish, and if you really look at us and the people who have really made a difference in the world, we look at it being human as being pretty superhuman. You know, I use that, maybe I misspoke in that way. I don't mean that we're not going to be at our best. It just means that I consider our normal best so much greater than what we all are today.
It's not about settling to be normal. It's about exceeding expectations, and that should be normal.
Yeah.
There you go. I we're in total alignment on that. And it really comes down to most people have no clue how good normal really is. And when they see it, they're just astounded at what they can do.
Yeah. People who are sick, when they feel better, then they understand what normal is supposed to feel like. Then they know how good it actually feels, how cool it is.
I would say a very unusual percentage of the people who focus on absolutely exceeding possibilities across, you know, mental and physical and nutritional and all these different domains, even like business. Oftentimes there are people who really dealt with a significant health issue early in life, and that taught them a new level of awareness as to what normal is and what not being normal is. So they just tend to get that focus that says, like, I'm going to do this right. And then they just apply themselves so much. That seems like you went down that path as well with your own osteoporosis. Is that kind of a motivator for you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when you become dependent on someone else, and then you feel better, being able to be dependent on yourself and really do everything that you want to do and make sure that you get everything accomplished that you want to accomplish and just taking it on head on. I mean, that's really what you get out of knowing that, you know, you almost couldn't.
Very, very cool. All right. You wrote about something I've been meaning to ask you guys about. So Amira and Jason, you write about everyday micronutrient depleters. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about what those are? Because I thought that was a really cool idea.
So this is a term that we created in the book to try to, you know, to try to teach people all the things that they should be looking for in their lives. So we talked a little bit about the diet, right? So people, you know, we talked about that, you know, if somebody first they choose a dietary profile. So let's say I choose the paleo or, you know, the higher, you know, kind of the hybrid of it, like what you guys do. And then, so there's that. And then the next thing I do now, I have to evaluate my lifestyle. So these lifestyle things are everyday micronutrient depleters. They can be things like drinking. They can be things like alcohol, I mean. They can be things like drinking coffee, smoking, pollution, hurried lifestyle, the stress that we get from a hurried lifestyle, dieting. And this includes things like bariatric surgeries or stomach staplings. It can be the lifestyle choices we choose. So maybe if we're eating gluten-free, we have to take into account what that's going to mean. Maybe we're going to eat raw foods. We have to take into account what that's going to mean. Or for vegans, like we discussed, what's that going to mean? So all of these are everyday micronutrient depleters. It can even be things like things found in our food, like sugar, tannins found in wine and coffee and tea, caffeine. So there's a lot of them. And these are all those things that even a perfect person who's thinking, you know, I eat a pretty perfect diet, at least I think I do. But now we have to add one more thing to the equation. And this is where, you know, a lot of people have missed out in the past. You know, they only just do that first line. They write down, okay, I got my, you know, X amount of micronutrients in. But now we better start minusing, because all those things that I just talked about and a lot more subtract from the amount of micronutrients that we have taken in. And the more we exercise and the more stressed we are and the more coffee we drink and the more alcohol we drink, the more we have to take off of that overall number.
That is totally true, in that when you take those things in that are really bad for you, they're going to deplete your micronutrients or at least increase your demand for replacement micronutrients. But I've got to ask about mycotoxins, which is one of my sort of personal maybe smoking guns and a lot of health problems. Do you look at mycotoxins in your research? These are the toxins formed by fungi that naturally occur in the food supply, although they're very aggressive ones now.
You know, I can't say that I've done a lot of research on that. I can certainly do some, and we can have a discussion later on about that.
That would actually be really fun. In fact, I can send you guys some info offline. But
yeah, very cool.
In short, for instance, coffee, one of the things that you called out there, 91.7% of this year's coffee crop has mycotoxins in it, at least if it's from South America. But it turns out that toxin-free coffee, which is produced a very specific way and didn't have an insect infestation and is organic from the right soil, et cetera, is an amazing antioxidant source that doesn't have the micronutrient depleting problems that are well known for coffee. So I think that as we dig really into what happens with biochemistry and all, that there's amazing evidence about, you know, what happens if you add 2 parts per million of this toxin. So I have a line of toxin-free coffee on the site that universally people drink it, and whenever I get feedback, it's, oh my God, I didn't feel any stress. I didn't get jittery. My hands didn't get cold. I didn't get a headache, even though coffee always does that to me. And it's that, did the coffee suck the micronutrients out of you? Did it make you feel bad? Did it stress your adrenals? Or did it not have bad stuff that would have depleted you even more?
Now, a lot of good foods and good beverages get bad reputations because they're mismanaged and badly factory farmed and poorly, you know, filled with those toxins that you're talking about. So yeah, that doesn't surprise us in the least. I mean, meat's the same way. People who do studies on meat and say it's bad for you, it's going to kill you and all this stuff. You know, it's because it's being, you know, pumped up with antibiotics and it's being fed grain and it's, you know, it's the same thing. But yeah, that wouldn't surprise us in the least. And most of these everyday micronutrient depleters, a lot of them have great beneficial qualities as well. So that's another thing we go over in the book, is we talk about, while they're everyday micronutrient depleting factors and we want people to be aware of them, a lot of them also have good side effects, such as exercise. and coffee.
Yeah, I'd like to say one thing about coffee too. I'm a huge fan of coffee. You know, I'm a big believer in making sure that you get your organic coffee or coffee that's been produced correctly, like you're saying, without those toxins. And what a lot of people don't know is that coffee is like the number one source of antioxidants on the planet. I mean, much yes. higher than even vegetables. I mean, not just by a little bit, but by a lot. So when we do talk about them as being a micronutrient depleter, you know, it's mostly the caffeine that takes out a little bit of calcium. But you're right. You're getting 100 times of those other good micronutrients or those antioxidants from drinking something like coffee. If we're just aware of just a little bit of caffeine or the little bit of calcium depletion, we can easily turn that around and make coffee a real superfood.
Well, based on what you just said, if you're a coffee fan, I'm going to send you a bag of Bulletproof upgraded coffee afterwards.
We would love to try
bonus.
It.
It's a different experience, I tell you.
Awesome. We will be waiting for that.
Cool. I'll make sure to get your shipping address when we're off the show here.
That's cool.
You also mentioned something about a nutrivore, which is also seems like it goes hand in hand with the everyday micronutrient depleter avoidance. Can you define a nutrivore and maybe how much coffee they should drink? No, I'm just kidding. But do tell us more about the nutrivore side.
Only the kind of coffee, though.
Amen.
Well, a nutrivore, like we said, a nutrivore is someone who they could be a paleo, they could be vegetarian, vegan, low carb, low fat. What a nutrivore, all these groups can have in common is that they understand that the most important thing and the reason that they're eating is to eat the most nutrient-rich foods, is to reach micronutrient sufficiency. So a nutrivore has three steps to their life to create this micronutrient-sufficient lifestyle. The first is eating the rich micronutrient-rich foods, and that we talk about, you know, the local, the organic, the grass-fed, the pastured chickens, all that kind of great stuff that I know that you eat as well. And then the second is to reduce the everyday micronutrient depleters in your life, or at least be aware of the ones that you do want to reduce, because not all of them are really bad for you. And the third thing would be to supplement if you need to, because we're not perfect. We know I still want to have my glass of wine at the end of the night. And I, you know, not every day that I'm traveling on the road am I going to find that perfect menu with perfect micronutrient-rich foods. So we recommend to take a supplement that's going to, you know, fill in that gap and get you up that extra space that you need to become micronutrient sufficient so you can prevent disease.
Okay, so nutrivore basically makes better decisions along the way in order to get the right nutrition, and maybe when they make a poor decision does something to address the deficiency.
Yeah, the nutrivore really just focuses on that creating micronutrient sufficiency in their life, no matter what dietary profile they're following. It's really our stab at a unification of all the dieting profiles. You know, one of the big things that, you know, I've noticed over the last 20 years of being in this business is there's a real fractioning that goes on amongst the different groups. I mean, it's very hard to get, you know, a low carber to sit down and talk with a vegan, or, you know, a vegetarian to talk, you know, with a paleo, or, you know, it's just, there's a lot of infighting. And I feel that we have so much power as a unified group. If we could just come together somehow, if there was just one common element where we could get these people, everyone together and say, you know, that's one thing that we can all get behind. And in our research and in our travels, you know, our kind of aha or eureka moment was the fact that, wait a minute, there is one common thing that every single one of these dietary profiles needs to really think about. Like we said, that's being micronutrient sufficient. And like we said, that's because if they're deficient in calcium, D, and K, no matter what profile it's going to be, they're going to get that disease. And so if we can use that one common thing to start to bring people to the table to have a talk about something that we're not disagreeing on, we're hoping that that can, you know, can foster further talk and help us to kind of create one voice where we can really start to make a difference in what we're in our foods and force the farmers and the grocers to bring in the foods that we really want, those micronutrient rich and dense foods.
I think you make a great point there about talking about how micronutrients is really one of the few things everyone can agree on. I'm not sure you're going to find a person who says being deficient in something is good for you. So I love
right.
that. And one of the things that we really stress on the blog and with the Bulletproof Diet or Upgraded Paleo is being sufficient in nutrients, but also being low in toxins. And we find that one of the reasons we call it Upgraded Paleo is because I think we do pay a little more attention to micronutrient sufficiency than other maybe forms of paleo might. What are some of the nutrients people who are following a paleo type diet might still be deficient in, even though they're eating these foods like you were talking about?
Right. So it's, again, when we're talking about the paleo diet, the great thing is you've got your meat, you've got your vegetables, you've got your fruits, you've got your nuts. So you've got the foods that will bring in that spectrum of the essential micronutrients, but then you have to actually talk about the individual. So again, it's going to be different across the board. You know, how many of the everyday micronutrient depleters are affecting this particular individual? That, you know, that one person could eat the exact same thing as another, but if they're hot, really stressed out and they're drinking a lot of alcohol and they're, you know, they're smoking and, you know, and they're exercising a lot, then obviously that exact same diet isn't going to come anywhere near to fulfilling micronutrient sufficiency for that person as it would for the person who didn't have those everyday micronutrient depleters.
So now here's a follow-on to that. What about prescription drugs and pharmaceuticals and micronutrients? What's the relation there? What are the really bad ones? Are there any that are not harmful at all? How does that work?
Well, I wouldn't say there's any prescription drugs that aren't harmful. Prescription over-the-counter medications just deplete essential micronutrients, which can either exacerbate the same condition or can initiate a new deficiency condition or disease to take place. People really don't think before popping pills, and it's really unfortunate. I mean, now we're seeing these, you know, obviously our celebrities are falling left and right with these prescription medications, and it's very sad, but it's even happening everywhere you look. I mean, everywhere you go, people think antacids are fine. Well, antacids are going to make it so your micronutrients can't be absorbed in your stomach. So that's a problem. People, you know, say you're getting a fever and you just want to pop something because you feel a shiver coming on. You want to lower your fever. Well, you know, that's going to actually deplete you of your zinc and your vitamin C. And those are two things that are really going to help you fight anything that you're catching on right now. That's going to actually lower your immune system. So, I mean, those are some of the lesser ones. But, I mean, CoQ10 deficiency is going to cause a heart problem. And unfortunately, they're giving people people are taking this Lipitor and it's going younger and younger as it's being prescribed even to children now. And it's been proven that it's going to cause a CoQ10 deficiency, and a heart disease and heart failure is actually a problem of CoQ10 deficiency. So we're just going to see more and more chronic conditions forming as people start medications earlier in life.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's a good point. I mean, you know, again, if you're a paleo dieter and you're on medications, that again comes into the equation. You know, you're going to be much more likely to be deficient in your essential micronutrients if you are taking over-the-counter prescription medications. I think it's important to point out that paleos, you know, they typically have a better understanding of ancestral cooking, fermentation, sprouting. You know, they understand that, and they're going to get the benefits of that. It's really important that we have great gut bacteria, because if you remember, our gut bacteria not only helps to produce some of our micronutrients, like vitamin K2, for instance, but it also helps us to absorb those micronutrients. So, you know, it's a big picture. We want strong gut flora. We want as many of micronutrients going into our foods, into our body as possible. And we want as little toxins in our body as possible. And when we put kind of all this together, this creates a very clear picture and pathway to optimal health.
Okay, I would buy that. Although, what about, say, thyroid hormone? It seems like there might be some prescription drugs that actually help you take up your micronutrients.
I'm not particularly aware of. I'm sure there are some that are going to help you with absorbing micronutrients for people who have a problem absorbing micronutrients. But if you're on a medication, you're probably giving it for something that was caused by a micronutrient deficiency in the first place.
So, of course, that would be iodine deficiency, yeah. And it being displaced by fluoride and halides. But basically, yeah, it's definitely there. And I know there was a time when I was like extremely anti-pharmaceutical. And as I got to know more about the biochemistry side of things, I think there's a very short list of ones where there's not a lot of side effects, and some of them actually seem to have anti-aging things, but I agree, like 99% of pharmaceutical drugs should be looked at with extreme skepticism if you're looking to live a long time and to just maximize health.
Yeah, I don't want to come off as anti-pharmaceutical either, really. I mean, I think that there's a time and a place especially in our society, the way that it is now, where, you know, physicians need to prescribe certain medications. But I always tell my patients that, you know, it's really important to try to talk to your doctor and come up with a plan to get off of the medication over a period of time. If you need it as a crutch right now because your condition is such that you do, then that's great. Then you've diagnosed your problem, you've got your condition under control, and now let's work on a lifestyle program so that we can eventually get you off of that medication, so by reversing the lifestyle things that caused the problem in the first place. So, you know, I agree in that aspect. And so while medications certainly have micronutrient deficiency or depleting effects, I think there's definitely a place for them in our society as well.
I'm glad that we both kind of share that. I've found that sort of middle path where, you know, be as natural as you can, but if it's not working, and do what you have to do in order to get it working.
Absolutely.
There's another technique that's out there. So a lot of the people who follow the Bulletproof Executive are into anti-aging, and I run an anti-aging nonprofit. And part of that involves this long-term caloric deficiency, caloric-rich diets. We're eating 30% less calories, but you're micronutrient dense. What about things like that? We have sort of severe dieting, but with adequate micronutrients. Have you come across that? What do you think about that?
Well, I think the science speaks for itself. I mean, if you want anti-aging and you want longevity, I mean, I think the science shows that low calorie has been proven to deliver that. So I think that, you know, I think that as we move towards this, where we're going in our world, and we find people who really will pay the money and want that to live to, you know, the 200 mark or beyond, I think that's what they're going to get to. They're going to get to the point where you take in a very minimal amount of macronutrients and a maximum amount of micronutrients, or I shouldn't say maximum, a sufficient amount of micronutrients. And that ultimately will probably equate to the best option for longevity.
And when we went to these different places all around the world, it's not like you saw the local tribe sit down for, you know, 3 squares and 2 snacks and gorge themselves. I mean, it certainly was in a constant state of how much food they could eat. They had, I mean, the most micronutrient-rich foods because they were so fresh. I mean, the soil was never destroyed. And it was amazing. I mean, they had small meals, and they were all very healthy. So, yeah, I mean, it definitely makes a lot of sense.
You're both fans of the long-term caloric restriction model. What about the other sort of severe dieting Sorry, go ahead. So you're both fans of the long-term caloric restriction sort of diet, as long as the micronutrients are adequate. What about other kind of severe dieting where people go on low-calorie diets, you know, crash diets to lose weight, and other sort of, you know, 1,500 calories of Weight Watchers a day kind of thing? What do those do to micronutrient deficiencies usually?
Well, they destroy them. So, you know, yeah, I mean, we're definitely not fans of starving yourself. I mean, yeah, you're going to get the low calorie effect, but that low micronutrient effect is then going to create deficiency holes in our bodies that will eventually, I mean, here's the fact. If you have an essential micronutrient that isn't being delivered in the minimum amount needed by your body has no other choice but to create a deficiency disease. I mean, triage theory basically states that, you know, your body will allocate the micronutrients that you do have so that you'll be able to live, you know, for the short term. But there will be ramifications for not having the minimum amount needed to run the body properly. I mean, that's just, I think common sense for most people.
So I think we would agree that self-imposed famines as a way to lose weight are maybe a bad idea.
As a way to lose weight, for sure.
I mean, you can't stay on it. It's not sustainable. The person is just going to end up, you know, sick and hungry, and then they're going to gorge themselves. I mean, that's why people fall off diets, is because they get these cravings and their body is just basically calling out for these micronutrients. The only way it knows how, which is through food.
I think that's a great point. And it's funny because whenever the government is recommending, you know, a way for people to lose weight, it's always eat less, move more. That's kind of the flip side of that, and it's my next segue is, what happens for people who are maybe exercising excessively? is that going to exacerbate micronutrient deficiencies? So you have somebody who's not only eating a super low calorie diet, but also, you know, going out and running marathons. What is that going to do to their micronutrient status?
That's going to bring it down even more. I mean, so again, you know, if you restrict your calories, you're restricting your micronutrients too. Unless, of course, you aren't, and you're restricting calories and you're supplementing those micronutrients. I mean, you have to be pretty smart about it, because, you know, most multivitamins don't provide everything that you need. So, you know, we're not talking about just restricting your micronutrients across the board and then supplementing with, you know, 10 or 20. You really have to know what you're doing in order to do that. But if you're restricting your calories, not supplementing properly, and then exercising on top of it, that's a double prescription for micronutrient deficiency. I think a lot of people who do that might feel good in the short term, because they're, you know, their digestive systems are clean. There's not a lot going on in there. They're kind of on this runner's high. You know, they flip in and out of a ketogenic state, which can, you know, can certainly improve your feeling, and you almost feel superhuman. And nothing wrong with a ketogenic state with micronutrient sufficiency attached. But over the long run, I mean, it's just a simple equation of, you know, a mathematical equation. I mean, if you keep minusing, you're never going to get a positive number out of being deficient.
That's an excellent point. And it brings me to my next question, which switches gears a little bit, but it's still talking about one of the other micronutrient depleters that you talked about in the book, and that's food preparation. How does how we prepare and cook food influence the nutrient density of that food?
Oh, completely. I mean, there's a lot to consider when trying to figure out how you're going to make your meal. I mean, first of all, it starts with peeling. If you peel all your vegetables, you're peeling off some of the micronutrients. You just buy good vegetables that are clean and organic. You don't have to worry so much about the pesticides and trying to get the coatings off. And so basically, that's a good place to start with trying to limit the amount of peeling you're doing to all of your foods. Also, how you cook it. I mean, we don't want to hear anyone boiling their vegetables until they're limp. I mean, you know, we have family members that still like to do that, and we understand that that's what they grew up with, but they have to understand that the micronutrients are being lost the longer something is being cooked. And we tell them, if you're going to do that, use that water to make rice, or use that water as stock for soup, because basically all your micronutrients are going to be left in there. I mean, it's simple things. It's like, you know, when they process the wheat, there's almost nothing left in the wheat. To cover your pot. No one thinks that covering your pot when you're cooking is that important, but it does two things. It actually keeps the light from affecting any vitamin B2, anything that's light sensitive, but it also, you know, doesn't let any of the steam escape, which is also going to seal in those water soluble nutrients. So there's lots and lots of tips in the book about, you know, better ways to cook. But you know, it's a lot of common sense. And I think that a lot of people are realizing that, you know, the fresher something tastes and the more crisp and you know, natural a vegetable is, it's probably got more of its micronutrients in it.
The idea that healthy food should taste good seems kind of amazing to me, that it's amazing to people, but people have learned from, you know, 30, 40 years of basically being told to eat cardboard because it's good for them that, you know, healthy food should taste bad. And it's my experience that if you want to be more superhuman, that what you eat should be full of, you know, real food, but it should also kind of taste amazing, because that tasting amazing is your body saying, I got what I wanted. Do you agree
absolutely,
with that?
Absolutely. We tell people that, and we're surprised as we travel around the world when we tell them this, they kind of scratch their head and say, well, that makes sense. But micronutrients are the flavor in the food. That's what you're tasting. You're not tasting protein. You're not tasting the fat. You're not tasting the carbohydrates. You're tasting the micronutrients. So when you have a tomato that's grown in rich soil and you picked it that day and it tastes amazing, if you leave it sit for another week or two, it'll taste just like ours do in the grocery store. You know, I mean, as you lose those micronutrients, you lose the flavor. With the more flavor, more micronutrients, and that's a great way. That's the you know, your tongue is also part of your body that tells your brain that, you know, what's in the food. And since we brought it up, it's another one of my pet peeves. You know, we've got a lot of these now artificial flavors out there, and these artificial flavors are tricking our bodies into thinking that there's micronutrients in the foods, which is actually causing us to crave a lot of these artificially flavored foods. So we're, you know, our bodies are we're craving it because our tongue has been telling our brain, hey, there's a lot of micronutrients in this thing. It's not a lot of micronutrients. It's just a lot of flavor. And they're using that to addict people to certain foods.
It's amazing. If you do it, like MSG is one of my favorite ways of doing that. If you put MSG in a meal at a restaurant, the odds of someone purchasing an additional drink or a dessert go up by something like 30% if memory serves, from a study that I've come across over the years. That's pretty amazing. So these artificial flavors mess with you.
Oh, totally. And now, you know, they're just hiding them. I mean, you know, you come out with MSG is bad. So, okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to come up with 30 other names to hide it under. I mean, and it's really bad practice. It's bad business. And it's up to you guys and people like us to try to get it out there that these foods aren't good for you under any name.
Yeah. Hydrolyzed corn protein. You'll see that in on a package. That's really just another name for MSG. You know, they try to make these names that don't sound scary because they want us to look at the package and say, oh, well, that's it. Just bypass it. But we really have to become aware of the different names and what they mean on our food packaging.
We've talked about a lot of the kind of smaller aspects of all this, with like food processing, exercise, what we eat, how we prepare food, all this. But you guys really published a study that brings all of this down to just the macro level and looked at how different diets provide nutrients and whether or not they're sufficient. Can you talk about this study? We mentioned it on a podcast recently because we thought it was so well done and so interesting. How much food do you really have to eat in order to provide micronutrient sufficiency for these various diets?
A lot is what we found. Now, I only looked at four diets. So I looked at the South Beach diet, the Atkins diet, the DASH diet, and the Best Life diet. And I figured, you know, if we put those four diets together, you've got, you know, a couple million people there following these programs. So there's a lot of people who are affected by these four diets. And I liked them because they were different. You know, one was a low carb, one was a Mediterranean, one's kind of a low fat. And then the DASH diet was one that was created by a team of nutritional and medical professionals specifically to help with high blood pressure. So, And really recommended by so many different people out there. What we found is, or what I found is that it would take on average 27,575 calories on average now between the three diets, some were higher and some were a little bit lower, calories per day in order to become micronutrient sufficient based on the exact recommended menus that they recommended in their own text. And we took the foods right down to the last grain of salt. And so that was really, really shocking to me. Now, what we did later on in the study is we took six of the micronutrients that were commonly deficient or completely deficient, you know, throughout, and we took those out and we reevaluated it then, I think maybe it was six or seven of them. I can't remember off the top of my head. For the other 20 or 21 essential micronutrients. And by doing that, we got the calories down to around 3,400 a day, somewhere in there. Don't quote me on that, but for sufficiency. But even that is still pretty high for most people. If you're a woman eating 3,700 calories a day, that's probably twice what you really need. And so what that told us was that we're in big trouble here in America if we think that we can just eat a balanced diet, again, whatever that means, any one of these dietary profiles, and think that we can get those essential micronutrients that we need. We just can't.
And then add on top of that the fact that this was before we take into account those everyday micronutrient depleters. So this is if you're doing everything perfect with the diet plan, and then you also didn't follow their advice, and you didn't go to the gym, and you didn't have any stress, you didn't do anything wrong for the entire day.
Yeah, it didn't take into account how a person might be cooking the food, if they're microwaving the food, or like Samira said, any of those, or where the food's from. So, I mean, this gave us a really good indication, you know, especially for Mira and I, to say, okay, we really need to stop talking about the macronutrients for a little bit here and really start to focus on what we think is kind of the hidden epidemic, which is that micronutrient deficiency. And once we fix that problem, I think the macronutrient equation and kind of argument will fall in line a little bit easier for people.
That makes great sense. And the really cool thing is that macronutrients with the right micronutrients generally taste good. So people, hopefully, as they start eating more whole foods, will just naturally, as they're focusing on micronutrients, get the right macronutrients, and sort of vice versa. That seems to happen when you focus on, you know, non-manufactured foods.
Yeah, quality foods are just So they taste so much better. And once somebody starts to get a little bit educated in how to find these quality foods, it's amazing how, I mean, you become like so interested in it. And because it does taste so much better, like people really, and you know, put their time into finding them, and they get more, you know, first it starts with a change, making one small change. And they're like, wow, that grass-fed beef was really good. I wonder what, you know, the, you know, this thing is going to taste like and this thing. And it kind of just expands through their life until they get more and more whole, great, fantastic foods in their kitchens.
Yeah. It's like an adventure. You know, we tell people to build a relationship with your food again. That's one of the things that we saw on the Calton Project, was the people that in the remote and even the semi-remote areas had a real relationship with that food. Don't forget, they've raised that food. The food lives in their forests and in their rivers, and the food that they grew along their streams was theirs. They had a real connection to it. They went out and they picked it and they cooked it, and it nourished them and their families and their tribe. And that connection that existed there, I mean, that it was really a powerful and very magical thing. We've lost that in America. We grab, you know, some processed semi-food at a fast food restaurant and gobble it down in the back of a taxi cab while we're on the phone, while we're doing a million other things. We have no connection with our food, for most of us. And I think that's one of the main reasons why we've allowed so many of these processed foods to sneak into our lives, because no one's looking.
It's true. People don't look, but they can sense it. When I throw, you know, a dinner party and I'll invite some people over who maybe haven't seen the Bulletproof Diet or really understand where I come from food, they'll sit down and they'll eat something, and then it's like a look comes over their face, and then they just can't stop. Can I have some more? Can I have some more? And, you know, yeah. These petite women eat, you know, 5 pieces of steak. And you're like, okay, you can have as much as you want. But it's like their body going, that's what I needed, was, you know, those nutrients that were in that food that I haven't had in a long time. So it's literally like a kind of hunger that I don't normally come across.
That's exactly it. That's that hidden hunger. When we start to take the foods that have those micronutrients, the body immediately realizes it. And it's going to tell her, eat more of that food, because that's what we've been missing.
We make, sometimes we'll make a coconut oil mayonnaise for people. And it's amazing. You would think that it was like this dip that people just all of a sudden think they need to like stick their whole face in it just to eat up as much as they can. I'm like, have you not had any good fats lately?
I have this recipe on the site for Bulletproof Coffee, which is, you know, the low toxin coffee blended with grass fed unsalted butter instead of cream, so you don't get any denatured casein, as well as MCT or coconut oil.
And our grandmother's taking it. The girl Bulletproof
Nice.
Coffee.
There you go. And so you guys are into that as well, at least you've seen it. But I tell you, it's the same exact thing. You get a friend, she had just the butter and the MCT oil mixed with a little bit of water. I was going to pour it in coffee, and she had a sip and said, can I just drink this? And she called me up 2 hours later. She'd taken a whole can of coconut milk and a whole stick of butter, blended them, and drank the whole thing. And she's like, I don't feel so good. I'm like, well, why did you do that? It was because her body was like, don't miss up this chance to have that food, right?
Yeah.
It's exactly what it is. You know, people don't realize how powerful MCT is. I tell you, it's, you know, I've been prescribing it to my clients for 20 years, and I'll tell you,
wonderful.
It is a magical short chain fat.
So you guys are MCT fans. In fact, I remember that now. I think that was mentioned in the book. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's fantastic, you know, and you're right. I mean, if you put this, I mean, I like Mira said, I told my grandmother's 94 and she's very healthy. She's not on one medication, by the way. And still takes about 6 or 8 cruises a year. And she walks several miles, you know,
every day.
So, you know, and she, you know, she's very, very healthy. And it shows that you can do that. When I heard about the Bulletproof Coffee, it was something that I had never thought about. And I thought to myself, that would be great, well, for everyone, but I wanted her to try it. And she did it. She loves it.
She might be the oldest person who's had Bulletproof Coffee. I've given it to my grandmother.
Oh, there you go. We'll take a photo for you.
That's so cool. I love hearing that. Well, we're coming to the end of the show, and there's a question that we ask every guest on the show, or in this case, every 2 guests. And it's, what are the top 3 things that people can do to become better at everything? So this is your whole life experience, any domain, everything at all. The top 3 things that are most important.
Dedication, focus.
Yeah, for me, it's kind of, I've always had the three D's: dedication, drive, and discipline. You know, I think those are the key. You know,
for me, it's have fun doing it. Smile, enjoy the ride.
Fun. I like that one. Well, thanks for sharing that. And it's really amazing the variety of answers we get there. And I really like the focus you've got there on the letter D. I mean, my name is Dave. I can. Just joking. But in all seriousness, that's right. You know, people really focus themselves. They can be better at everything they do because they're now paying attention. And that includes their diet. That includes everything else you do as well.
Absolutely. Relationships, everything.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, you know. Keep learning too. That's another thing. And a lot of times people kind of get stuck and they think, well, you know, I kind of know a lot about this. Listen, I think I know at least a lot about nutrition, but I'll tell you, every single time I sit down and talk with a new client or, you know, I'm always learning something new. I often tell people, I wish I knew all the things that I've forgotten about nutrition because, you know, I just keep learning more and more and more. And it seems like it's almost endless. So I would highly recommend, no matter what you think you know, there's always something more out there to learn.
Amen. And it keeps changing too. You got to stay on top of it.
Absolutely. Especially in our field. You know, I mean, it's really an exciting time now. I kind of equate it to the electronics, you know, age, what that is now and what it was even 10 years ago. What's happening in nutrition today is going to be the difference between the brick phone in the 1980s and today's iPad, you know, with what's happening in supplementation and in nutrition and in micronutrient sufficiency and in longevity. So it's going to be really an amazing time over the next 10 to 20 years for those of us who are interested in this topic.
You're absolutely right. This is a golden age, and it's just the beginning of the golden age for real nutrition. And it's not happening because of doctors or because of big governing bodies. It's happening because of big data and the internet and the fact that we can put together our own studies and we can do our own correlations. And it's really sort of a citizen science time, and I'm pretty happy to be a part of it.
Yeah, we are too. We're very excited.
And also, I'd like to thank you as we're really coming to the end here. Thank you for the contribution you've made with your book and just for, you know, paying attention and going out and seeing these places firsthand and writing about it and bringing this so other people can learn through your own experience. That's a wonderful thing to do.
Well, thank you. And we hope people do read the book and we hope that they learn from it and they use the information and then they share the information.
So Mira and Jason, tell our listeners where they can find out more about you, more about your book.
They can go to our website, Kalton, C-A-L-T-O-N, nutrition.com. The book is up there. It's called Naked Calories. They can also get it at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, pretty much in all the bookstores. It was sold out on Amazon until yesterday. They finally got their next shipment in. We did a reprint, so that's awesome. And we have two great quizzes on there that are both free. We have a lot of great information in the Discovery Center, and we actually do answer people's emails. So we look forward to hearing from people and also definitely sign up for the blog because we've got some really, really fun stuff coming out this week.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you should know that we have some really, really we have a big blog coming out tomorrow. So I don't know
when this will come out.
I don't know when this will come out, but keep your eyes out for it no matter what.
Okay, we'll definitely be watching.
Excellent.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Mira.
Thanks, Arnie. Yeah. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you guys so much.
Now we'll start with the Upgraded Self Radio listener Q&A.
The first question is from Denver. After tweaking my diet, I'm almost 100% bulletproof and I've noticed massive differences in energy levels and I'm leaner and lighter than I've been in 13 years. My partner is struggling to break old eating habits and wanted to know whether this is an all or nothing diet. Will following at 70% with the huge increase in good fats, especially the butter, still be a good thing? Will this diet be sensible for our 2-year-old son?
This is an awesome question because it turns out it's not possible to be 100% on the bulletproof diet because the entire diet is a spectrum. You can always make one decision that's slightly better. So for instance, if you're eating all grass-fed meat, well, maybe you could be slightly better by eating grass-fed meat that was grown near the equator so it has optimized vitamin D. Now, I don't do that. No one on earth is going to do that. But you can always be slightly more perfect, and pursuing perfection will just create stress, which is not the goal of the bulletproof diet. Bulletproof people control their stress, and use it for their benefit. So don't worry about being 100% bulletproof. Worry about making better choices. Look at the infographic on our site, and you'll find that you can actually just make decisions that move you in the right direction. So 70% is better than no percent for sure. Just increasing butter for a lot of people creates over about 2 weeks some weight loss, as well as just a feeling of well-being as and mental function gets better. So the butyric acid that's in it, as well as the conjugated linoleic acid, really makes a difference in how you feel, at least a tablespoon a day. I would caution your partner that if they don't give up gluten, it's going to be hard to get a lot of these benefits. Gluten is bad for your brain, it's bad for your gut, and it's bad for your body. So this is just something that 90 or so percent of people ought not to eat. Even the people who can tolerate it okay don't benefit very much. We also have a blog post called 14 Steps to the Bulletproof Diet that will also maybe help you with your partner and just understanding how easy it is to do this. The next question you had was about whether it's going to be good for your two-year-old son. And the answer is it'll be one of the most profound things you can do for your two-year-old son's longevity, mental performance, and for your own mental stability. Two-year-olds who eat a high-fat diet don't tweak nearly as much as normal two-year-olds. My son is 2.5, and if I fed him what the people at, you know, his daycare oftentimes feed their kids, which is an excess of fruit and juice and these healthy vegan snacks, I see these little kids running around like starving people, hitting things and jumping up and down and really having a hard time with self-control. Animals, including people who are sated with proper amounts of fat, are calmer and happier. And little kids, if they eat enough fat, build bigger brains as they convert that fat into ketones and then back into the right saturated fats that they need for proper brain function. So you owe it to your kid to feed him Bulletproof. It'll make a difference.
The next question is from Kent. What brand of chlorella do you use and recommend for mercury absorption? And how much of it should one take?
I've used a variety of chlorellas. The problem with chlorella is that it's relatively expensive. So I tend to shop for chlorella that is grown in a low toxin environment, and usually it says on the bottle where it's from. I'm concerned about chlorella that comes from near Japan right now, which is where most of it's from. But as long as it's fractured cell wall, it's good. And if it's high in something called CGF, which is chlorella growth factor, that's even better and even more important, especially if you're going to be giving it to younger people like kids. So I can't say that I take one brand all the time. Sun chlorella is good. It's just quite expensive, but that's sort of the gold standard right now. I take about 30. Keep in mind, I weigh about 200 pounds. I take 30 to 40 of these things with a fishy meal so that it'll absorb mercury in the fish.
The next question is from Sean. I'm currently a few days into the Bulletproof Intermittent Fasting Plan, and I'm planning on trying it for a while and writing a blog post about my experience and results. I'm starting with some counterculture coffee that meets your guidelines, but I plan to order your coffee soon so I can compare the two as part of my post. Anyway, I have a few things I'd like to clarify to make sure I'm doing everything properly. I normally supplement my primal diet with creatine, fish oil, and vitamin D. Should I continue to use these during the fast? If so, should I only consume them during my first six-hour eating window, or is it okay to stick with my normal routine? I don't drink alcohol often, but if I choose to partake on a fast, would it need to be done in my six-hour window, even if it were liquor and soda water? And he has a few others, but let's tackle those first.
So, yes, it's okay to supplement with creatine, fish oil, and vitamin D. However, if you're doing a full-on rapid fat loss kind of fasting, you may find that creatine can induce nausea. So if it doesn't make you feel sick, that's fine. And I would really replace that fish oil with krill oil because it's already phosphorylated, and it probably will give you less burps anyway, which can be a problem. Since you're doing mostly just Bulletproof intermittent fasting as opposed to the rapid fat loss, I don't see any problem with taking all the supplements you normally take. Just take them during your food time. Don't take them in the morning. In terms of alcohol, I really don't recommend you do that if you're in the middle of Bulletproof intermittent fasting. But if you decide you're going to do it, you would do it during your six-hour window. You should then also follow what's in the alcohol infographic on the site, where you choose less toxic alcohol with fewer toxins and you do things to protect your liver so that you get the benefits of the alcohol, which, to be perfectly clear, I do not believe in the health benefits that are claimed for alcohol. The benefits are fun and taste. You can get those without the pain.
One other problem with taking creatine during, if you're just doing regular fasting, is that it does cause water retention, and if you're not weight training, you might not get as much benefit out of it. So you might, it might mask weight loss too.
It's a double-edged sword if you're looking to just get lean, but if you're looking for cognitive performance as well, creatine is kind of a slam dunk, at least if you're past college age. If you're in college, we're not as convinced from the studies that it's going to make a difference just because you have younger mitochondria.
His next question is, how important is limiting carb consumption in my eating window to optimize my body composition results?
It's pretty important if you're looking to get leaner. If you are doing a sort of carb reset day, you can certainly have a lot of carbs. But if you're doing intermittent fasting, there are guys out there who say you can eat cheesecake when you're doing it and it still works. And it does. It just works better if you keep your carbs limited because you stay in ketosis.
He also asks, how often do you recommend doing the fast days? Is it more beneficial to do it every day or to mix it up?
I usually recommend that people do it up to 5 times a week, but you don't do it every day all the time because you will get used to it and it'll have lower effect. And I wish I could quote which expert told me that. I don't remember. But my own experience from going on several weeks of it, I just felt like I wasn't getting the same benefit versus if I occasionally had a day where I would eat something for breakfast besides bulletproof coffee. I would, you know, have some eggs or whatever. So I definitely have a protein and fat breakfast 1 or 2 times a week. And the rest of the time I do this bulletproof intermittent fasting thing because it's just simpler and easier than it is to try and deal with a full breakfast, especially when I'm on the road.
The next question is from Zingbo. How do CES machines compare to binaural beats for effectiveness?
Wow, these are kind of two ends of the spectrum. Binaural beats are kind of a mid-1980s technology that were championed by a guy named Robert Monroe, who was a sound engineer who found he had an out-of-body experience when he heard binaural beats from playing two different tones in each ear. So from there, he developed a program, and binaural beats affect your brain. You can see what happens with an EEG. They're a relatively soft way of affecting your brain, and we have some much more advanced sonic ways of affecting the brain. In fact, I use some of those in the Bulletproof Mindware in the focus training module that I created, where we can really get your brain to move into something more quickly. CES, on the other hand, which stands for cerebral electrical stimulation, and that's something that I also use, that runs a very small shaped current between your ears to tell your brain what state to be in. CES is much stronger, and it creates lasting frontal alpha in a way that binaural beats are not likely to do. So I would say that CES machines are more powerful and stronger and longer lasting than binaural beats. Binaural beats don't let you sleep a lot less, but CES machines do, as one example of that.
How does sticking a paperclip in an outlet compare to CES machines?
You know, if your goal is to wake up, I have to say that sticking a paperclip in an outlet is definitely the way to go. Now, it's kind of funny, but the people really get wigged out when it comes to that idea of running electrical current across your brain. But we're talking about like far, far less than you get even from static electricity. It's a very small thing, but your brain works on very small amounts of very small amounts of current, so it actually makes you noticeably change how your brain works.
Cool. If you have questions for the podcast, you can contact us on Twitter, on Facebook, or by leaving a comment in the show notes for this episode. The show notes will be displayed on bulletproofexec.com, along with links to everything we talked about today.
All right, now it's time for the Biohacker Report, which is my favorite part of the show, at least some of the time. Our first report here is about short-term fasting and profound neuronal autophagy. This is research that was published from the Scripps Research Institute, which is down in La Jolla, California. And it was published in a journal. This is a super exciting journal called Autophagy. And I imagine it has about 7 readers, mostly scientists with long beards. But it's actually a really cool research. The research was about how intermittent fasting affects autophagy in mouse brains. Autophagy technically is when the lysosomes in your cells begin repairing and recycling proteins and damaged molecules. So this is basically your oven has a self-cleaning mode, your cells have a self-cleaning mode, and you want to turn on autophagy regularly so that your cells don't get intracellular gunk, the stuff inside the cells. In this study, mice were fasted between 24 and 48 hours, and then their brains were analyzed with electron microscopes. What the scientists found was that neurons clean themselves just like other cells. Now, that's really important because a lot of degenerative diseases happen around neurons, things that happen in the brain, things like MS, things like Alzheimer's. So knowing that your neurons are able to run the self-cleaning mode like your other cells is really important. This was not a human study, but there are several other studies out there that show short-term fasting may be beneficial for your brain as well as for your physical composition. So if this wasn't enough of a study to convince you to try bulletproof intermittent fasting, I don't know what would be.
The next study is also about fasting, and it's titled Training in the Fasted State Improves Glucose Tolerance During Fat-Rich Diet. This was published in the Journal of Physiology, and it was conducted by the Department of Biomedical Kinesiology in Belgium. The main objective here was to find out whether fasted training had the potential to induce superior and favorable adaptions to fat metabolism, glucose tolerance, and insulin sensitivity compared to fed state training. So they're looking at whether or not eating before a workout changes your metabolism in response to weight training. One of the sessions, the fed session, the fasted session was performed on an empty stomach after an overnight fast. The other session, the breakfast session, was performed in the fed state or postprandial state. Subjects were given breakfast of about 722 calories, which about 85% of which was carbs, 11% protein, and 4% fat. And then they trained for about 90 minutes after the meal. The fasted training produced better gene expression and enhanced nutrient uptake by the muscles. So basically more of what they're eating was converted into muscle tissue versus fat tissue. The researchers believed this was due to some sort of anabolic rebound effect, where by depriving your body of nutrients before the workout, your body had an even more increased adaptation to those nutrients after the workout. This needs a lot more research, but the takeaway is that you might want to eat the majority of your calories in the post-workout window instead of having a large meal beforehand. There are other studies which support this finding as well, including endurance athletes. And Martin Birkin actually wrote a great article on this study, and we'll have a link to the show notes so you can read it, because he does a really good analysis on it.
Our final biohacker report of the day is called A Neurophysiological Metabolic Model for Burst Suppression. And I have to say, these scientists really need some work on their headlines because, well, that's about as bad as it gets. But this did come out of the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and it was published in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Burst suppression is a brain state when your mind fires off a bunch of neurons and then stops for a little while. So it just completely pauses. You see this during anesthesia or when people are in a coma. Now, the study predicts and explains for the first time how burst suppression comes about when brain cells' energy supply becomes inefficient. The research shows that when brain cells have an impaired ability to use fuel, they stop working correctly. That means basically that when your neuronal mitochondria stop working, your brain starts shutting down. You can prevent this from happening by turning on autophagy, which you just heard about, by keeping your brain sharp through training, for instance, bulletproof mindwear, by avoiding stress, can you say M-Wave from the HeartMath Institute, and by eating the bulletproof diet. So it's kind of cool. The techniques we talk about here on the show and on the blog really do feed into this specific study that shows that your brain stops working when you don't have enough fuel. Also, MCT oil becomes even more important in this model because MCT oil is a very effective fuel for the brain, even if your brain's having a problem with glucose. So really cool study here that says, like, today you can clean your brain cells, your neurons, and that if you fuel them properly, they won't cause brain shutdown. That's kind of important. You'll find links to everything we talked about in our show notes at bulletproofexec.com, including a full transcript. If you liked this, you can help us out by leaving a positive ranking on iTunes or even by stopping by the blog and picking up a bag of Bulletproof Upgraded Coffee, which is the lowest toxin coffee that we know how to make that tastes awesome and makes your brain work great. Army, thanks. I'll see you soon.
See you, Dave.